a great pleasure to welcome you to our final day of the World YWCA's International Women's Summit on Women's Leadership and HIV and AIDS. We hope you've been enjoying the last few days and not too tired from last night's dinner. We've got a great panel to start the day off and some wonderful speakers. So please let me introduce Julie Kishiru from Nations Media, who's going to be moderating our panel today on If Women Really Matter, Where's the Leadership and Where's the Money?
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. Thank you all for joining us this morning. We look forward to the discussion on where the leadership and the money really is. Can you not hear clearly? Is that better? Okay. But before we do begin the session this morning, I'd like us all to welcome Anne-Marie Helland. She's a YWCA member from Norway. She's going to introduce an important action that we will all take together this morning. So Anne-Marie, do join us.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Jumble. At your seats this morning, there is a poster for you to take home. And almost all of you have a black postcard. And this postcard is for you to take action with now. The issue is pediatric AIDS, treatment for children, and even the proper diagnosis of the HIV virus for kids. The postcard contains a message to the big pharmaceutical companies that are making huge profits on HIV drugs and failing not to provide correct formulas for children because they think there is not enough money to be made in it. So join thousands of other people all over the world in telling these companies that this is not acceptable. And this is an action that you can take now. If you do not have a postcard on your seat, first of all, share with your neighbor. It is possible for two people to sign one card, or you can sign online. On the poster that you have on your seat is an address that you can go click onto, and then you can sign the postcard online. And please also remember to remind all of your friends to go to this address and sign the postcard online. On the left side of the black postcard that is in this room, at the bottom, please sign your name and organization. And if there's only one signature at the postcard, make sure that the people around you have access to sign also, and if not, they can sign your co-sign with you. And spread about. It's a white sheet that says, what are we asking for? It is about four or five such sheets on each row. This sheet contains the addresses, names and addresses of four big pharmaceutical companies who need to receive your message. Choose one of these and put their address on the right side of the card. And make sure that these white sheets are spread around so that everybody can write the address on. Then, when this session is over, you may place the cards in the basket at the door as you leave the hall. Thank you so much for joining this action today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anne-Marie. Well, we're very pleased to have with us a panel of women with a wealth of experience in matters of leadership and of funding for HIV/AIDS. Joining us today, we have Marie Bob Allport. I'll introduce everybody and then we will go to the discussion. So Marie is an anti-nuclear activist. Mari, how do you say it? Mairi is an anti-nuclear activist and an HIV/AIDS advocate. She's the founder of the Pacific Islands AIDS Foundation, PIAF. Marie was the first HIV-positive Pacific Islander to go public in the media. She spoke out at a regional conference. In taking this action, she put a face to the virus and helped put HIV/AIDS on the Pacific Islands agenda. Very important. Now, PIAF grew out of a need to have an independent task force voicing the needs of those infected and affected by HIV/AIDS in the islands, as well as to guide and fill gaps in the overall response in the region. The foundation works with all 22 Pacific Island countries and territories with emphasis on discrimination, gender, and treatment. Also with us today is Bisi Adeleye Fayemi. BC is a social entrepreneur and a philanthropist. She's the co-founder and executive director of the Africa Women's Development Fund. BC, this is the first Africa-wide fundraising and grant-making organization for Africa women. Before this, she was with Akina Mama wa Africa, an international development organization for African women, which is based in London with an office in Kampala, Uganda. Now, BC has an incredible profile. There's so much to go through. I'll try to do it very quickly. She was president of the Association of Women's Rights in Development, AWID, and one of our other panelists, Zawadi Nyong'o, is actually from AWID and will give us some of the research they've done. Now, BC was the co-chair of the International Network of Women's Funds. She's a board member of Resource Alliance. She's a board member of the International Women's Health Coalition. She's an editorial board member of Alliance Journal, a board member of the Partnership for Transparency Fund, a Synagos senior fellow. You can see she's a very busy lady. Let me wind up by saying that she recently received the Changing the Face of Philanthropy Award from the Women's Funding Network in the U.S. That's BC, Adeleye Fayemi. Also with us this morning is Patricia Mugambi Degwa. Patricia is the Eastern Central Africa Director of the Global Business Coalition on HIV/AIDS, TB, and malaria. This is based in Nairobi, Kenya. She facilitates partnerships with national business coalitions. She supports multinational and local companies in their responses to HIV and AIDS, and she further solidifies GBC's Africa field operations. Patricia joined GBC in 2001 as Director of Corporate Relations based in New York. She led the coalition's rapid growth, enabling it to secure its current 206 members. Moving on now to somebody you all know very well, but we will quickly introduce her as well. It's Dr. Musimbi Kanyoro, who, of course, is the General Secretary of the World YWCA, reaching over 25 million women and girls in 125 countries. And it's under her leadership that the World YWCA has prioritized HIV and AIDS and now delivers programs in over 70 countries in response to the pandemic. She's also a founding member of the Global Coalition on Women and AIDS and the Circle of Concerned African Women Theologians, and an alliance of international youth organizations working to address HIV/AIDS among young people. Terry McGovern is Program Officer, HIV/AIDS, Human Rights, Peace and Social Justice Program of the Ford Foundation. Now, Terry founded the HIV Law Project in 1989, where she served as Executive Director until 1999. Terry successfully litigated numerous cases against the federal, state, and local governments. While at the HIV Law Project, she developed a client training program which successfully prepares HIV-positive women to enter and to impact the policy arena. She joined the Ford Foundation as HIV/AIDS and Human Rights Program Officer in 2006, May. Zawadi Nyong'o, as I mentioned, is with AWID, that's the Association for Women's Rights in Development, Program Coordinator. Where is the money for women's rights is what she's looking at. Now, Zawadi was born and raised in a politically and socially conscious family right here in Kenya. She has been educated in social justice activism for as long as she can remember, she tells us. She graduated in 2004 with a degree in international law and women's studies and third world studies as well. She's had the opportunity to contribute to work within the Federation of Women's Lawyers in Kenya, Urgent Action Fund Africa, and now with AFF. And last but certainly not least, Sono Aibe is with us, and Sono is the Acting Director of the Population Program of the PACARD Foundation. Sono is currently overseeing grant making under two portfolios, Global Institutions and Global Solutions and Ethiopia. She developed grant making strategies for adolescent reproductive health and advocacy and initiated grant making in the Philippines and Myanmar. Prior to that, she was project officer at the Japanese Organization for International Cooperation in Family Planning. That's in Tokyo, Japan. She co-managed family planning projects in Vietnam, in Laos, and Thailand. So clearly, we have an incredible panel of women here to discuss the issues, and we move on swiftly to do just that. Our first speaker is Mairi. Did I get it right?
Mairi.
Mairi, I'm still trying. Okay. Mairi is going to tell us, how can funds for positive women be used to achieve positive change, and how would AIDS resources be more effective for positive women if they were adequately resourced? Thank you.
Jambo, jambo. I would like, first of all, to say thank you to the people of Kenya, the women of Kenya, for allowing me to be here today and stepping on your land and allowing our Pacific delegates to be here amongst you. It's been a wonderful and humbling experience, that of coming to visit you here and share some of the issues that you go through. It's been overwhelming in the last 4 days, and lots of issues, but also lots of strength and energy that are coming out of all the women that we are in this conference. And every day that I have been waking up, I have been thanking the Lord for pulling, for giving the strength, the wisdom, and the energy, the foresight to those women who have put this conference together. Thank you so much. I'm 32 years old. I've been living with HIV for almost 10 years. It has not been an easy road, but there's been some wonders out of this. And I always think of HIV as a disease, a challenge in life that allows a person to become a better person, a better self, but also to allow others to become better persons. When the doctor sat next to me to give me my results, I was actually sick and finishing my studies, and I did not think that out of anything that I was tested for, HIV was the one that was going to come back to me positive. So I agreed to the test, believing that that one was not going to come back positive. So the day he actually came and sat next to me to give me the results, his sentence was like this: "Well, we have tested you. In fact, everything is negative, except HIV. And at this stage, you have developed AIDS, and you're in a very bad condition. Unfortunately, we don't have the resources to give you any sort of treatment, and the ones that are given available today, the ARVs. I was in Fiji finishing my studies. The only way out was for me to be able to go back to my country, because I knew that there, the medical health services was far more advanced than what was there in Fiji at that time. I guess in my path, there's a bit of uniqueness, and it's that the first person that came into my room in hospital on the same day, I actually told this friend of mine, "I do have pneumosis, but I also have AIDS." And one could be wondering, but why would you tell someone straight away? By fear of discrimination, by fear of rejection, by fear of what is he? What is she going to think of me? You know, I prayed as soon as I had gone through this shock of floating in the room, because it was too much of a trauma to be given a death sentence. As soon as I woke up, I cried. But my first thing was to pray and ask God, please give me peace. Please allow me to regain peace inside. And I guess that's probably one of the source of the strength that has been pushing me forward. And the second thought that came to me was to say, well, I haven't been an IDU. I haven't had a transfusion. So it has probably been through sexual intercourse. Well, I don't think I have done I don't think I have done it differently to most of my friends around me. So if today I'm actually in this bed with HIV and in fact AIDS, that is really that any of my friends, any of my cousins, my sisters around me could actually have it as well. That was an eye-opener. And that was the foundation of the work and the commitment that I've had for the last 10 years. And that is to tell women that HIV is only a test away. That HIV for you, if it hasn't come into your life yet, is only a matter of time. And provide women with the tools and resources to be able either to cope with it if it's already there, or be prepared to cope with it when it comes. When I went home, we were sitting in the living room and I disclosed it to the rest of my family, and particularly my mom. I've grown up going to church every Sunday. Even when I didn't want it to go, she would make sure that I get there. And I knew that out of any members of my family, she would be the toughest one to confront. When we sat in the living room, I had already told my father, I had already told my brothers, I expressed it to my mom. She did not move an inch. Where she was seated, just a meter away from me, she did not move an inch. She did not look at me. She stayed quiet and cried for another 5 hours. Now that, coming out of my mom, was a big change. She's always been the leader in our family, the one who decides, the one who makes the call. But for her not to react was something that I knew would happen, but I didn't think it was going to be that bad.
Myri, a powerful point that you make. In fact, the time is up, but I do want to allow you to go on for a few more minutes to tell us about how indeed the funding that we have can be used to effect positive change. But I think certainly a very powerful point that you have.
That's going to take 2 minutes. But the point of this is to say that unless you as mothers could not give the faith in your kids that if they are going to go through that, they are still safe with you at home. They will just not come to you. And I say that because a lot of women who have not yet faced HIV believe that their kids will just naturally come to them. And in the work that you will be doing in the future, I just wish to see more of that embracing movement of new generations that are coming and children who will be affected by HIV. Leadership, advocacy, and others, funding as well. To me, there are three words. First is to be consistent in what we do, in the knowledge that we acquire and the skills. Being accountable for what we do, it means that we have cleaned up our own backyard, before we go up there and try to spread a message. But it also means to have the support around us. And you will notice that once you've reached a certain level, high up there in the sea to try and keep the advocacy and the leadership, you become very isolated whether you have HIV or not. And so it's also important that amongst those women who have been able to go up there, for everyone else, that we are able to lean onto each other and find the strength and the energy to carry on. And I guess, and the last point will be to pass it on. Many of us tend to keep it all to ourselves. The power is not only something that men do or seek. It's also something that women seek. But for the sake of women itself and for the sake of humankind, we do all need to remind ourselves or to learn to pass it on. So there are strategies to access funding, and I don't really agree with the question I was given for this theme. If women matters, where are the resources? I'll probably say women do matter. Give us those resources. Thank you.
Thank you.
And have faith.
Thank you very much. Zawadi Nyong'o joins us now. Zawadi is going to share research that AWID has been involved in around funding for women's organizations in particular. And she's going to tell us what is happening to women's funding.
Habari ya asubuhi. That's good morning in Swahili. Thank you so much. On behalf of AWID, I just want to thank the YWCA for inviting us to share a lot of the research that we've been doing around funding for women's rights. I also want to thank Marie and all the other incredible women who are in this room. Right now my heart is racing just because I've had so many moments of inspiration, anger, hope, fear in the last few days, and I'm sure many of you have felt the same way. In the middle of the week, I called my mother to express some of what I was thinking and feeling. And she's currently in Siaya District, which is in Western Kenya, where I'm from, and where there's a very high prevalence of HIV and AIDS. And working with women who are discriminated against, who are dealing with cultural issues such as wife inheritance, where a woman may have lost her husband due to HIV and AIDS-related causes, and she's still inherited by the older brother who may be negative. Those are just some of the issues. And I thought, wow, wouldn't it be great for some of those women to be in this space? And I just want to ask, how many of you in this room right now know at least one woman who would have benefited from the networking, the capacity building, the sharing, even the healing that has gone on in the last few days, just by a show of hands? Okay, and how many women who would not have been able to afford to come to this meeting? And then also to ask the question, well, a lot of work came into just having us participate in this meeting. Resources were mobilized. This meeting, I gather, cost $2 million to put together. And yet, if you look at just as one individual, how much does it cost an average for us to pay for an air ticket, whether you paid for it yourself, your organization sponsored, or someone else sponsored? How many tickets cost more than $1,000 to get here? Just keep that number in mind as we go on. When you think about the issue of funding for women's rights, why is it important? Next slide, please. So the fact of the matter is, we've heard, we cannot engage in the work that we do around gender equality, women's rights, development without funding. We have to look at where money comes from, how it flows, and how to make it work to our advantage. So since 2005, AWID has been doing research on global trends and practices on the funding situation for women's rights. We've used literature reviews, interviews with donors and individual women activists and organizations, and an online survey that was filled by over 1,000 organizations. We believe this initiative is important, because one, money and financial flows are political issues, and as a feminist organization, this is important to us. Influencing funding is critical to any women's rights strategy. And by building the sustainability of women's movements, we can shift value systems, advancing the global development agenda. We also recognize that a lot of the gains in gender equality that have been made so far are as a result of women's work, however underfunded they are. So what is the context? From the research, we found that over half of the organizations that responded to the survey were working on HIV and AIDS issues. So although the research was not specifically targeted to HIV and AIDS organizations, we can see how the findings relate to the work of organizations doing this work. So we found that a lot of women's organizations are in a state of, survival and resistance, operating on minute budgets. Up to 66% of the organizations, this is over 1,000 organizations in different parts of the world working on different issues, had budgets of under $50,000. Only 4% had budgets of over $500,000, and the majority of these are based in the global north, in the US and in Western Europe. We also found, and if you remember that number, $1,000 to attend this conference, that would be like 10% of an entire organization's budget just to attend one meeting. Yeah? And we looked at, we asked organizations whether or not they found it easier or harder to raise money, and over half of them said that they were receiving less funding in 2005 than they were in 2000, and that they found it more difficult to raise funds and were spending more time and resources to do so. If we compare women's organizations to other social movements, we can see that the women's movement is severely underfunded. In 2005, for example, we took the budgets of all 729 organizations, and they reported having annual budgets altogether of $77.5 million. If you compare that to one single organization like Amnesty International that has $230 million, you can see how huge the discrepancies are. We also saw that majority of women's organizations depend on a limited number of sources of funding, and that these sources are also diminishing for various reasons, whether it's the aid effectiveness agenda that's shifting resources through governments instead of directly to civil society organizations, or rising conservatism and fundamentalism. Also, large private foundations are scaling up, so providing larger amounts of funding to fewer organizations. And we also asked organizations, well, how much would you really need to do the work that you want to do and that you need to do? And they said they would need to double their budgets. Now, if you consider that the majority of organizations have budgets of less than $10,000, even that is a conservative amount. And that's one of the challenges that we face as women's rights organizations, also operating in this culture of scarcity and not thinking big. So why not ask for $100,000 or, you know, $1 million? We asked them, and this is part of, so this is part of being stuck in this vicious cycle where donors say, well, small organizations don't have the capacity to absorb large amounts of funding, but without having bigger amounts of money, how do organizations build their capacity to then absorb larger amounts of funding? So we see that there's a huge gap between small organizations and big organizations earning up to $500,000 and up, so that the mid-range organizations find it increasingly difficult to access funding. So this is stifling the women's movement. Small organizations are staying small, and there's very little growth in the middle. So where is the money coming from? Just quickly, traditionally, funding for the women's movement has primarily come from bilateral and multilateral donors, large private foundations, international NGOs. But as I said before, the trends are shifting. Resources are reducing and going through governments increasingly for the reasons I mentioned earlier. We've also seen that increasingly, and I completely forgot about the slides. Just go next. Okay, so increasingly, women's funds are now playing a huge role supporting the women's movement. Although they're not providing the largest amounts in dollar amounts, women's organizations reported that they were the most common sources of funding. So this is something that we need to be aware of, and donors also should look at women's funds as partners, such as AWDF, Urgent Action Fund Africa, the Global Fund for Women, which is the largest women's fund, and was reported to provide $2.6 million in 2005. If you look at the top 20 donors in Africa in 2005, the Global Fund for Women was second out of the top 20. So there are, even though there are a lot of challenges, there are some opportunities. And for AWID, we talk about changing the way we look at fundraising. Okay. changing the way we look at fundraising, focusing on strengthening the women's movement, moving from the culture of scarcity to building solidarity across differences, and looking at thinking about alternative source, resource mobilization strategies. So there's a lot of resources that are available in the report. The time is limited. I just want to say that it is available. Our most recent report is currently being published. It's available and can be, you can send an email to zcanto, please go to the last slide, zcanto@awid.org, or check on our website, www.awid.org. It will be available in Spanish, French, and Arabic soon as well. Thank you very much, and sorry for the time.
Can you hear me? Thank you. I will ask our panel members, please, to keep it shorter because we do want to give the audience time to ask some of the very vital questions that I'm sure they do have. So next is Patricia Mugambi-Ndegwa. Patricia, please tell us, how are public-private partnerships strengthening the response to HIV and AIDS, and particularly with respect to women?
Thank you, Julie. Good morning, everyone.
Yes.
You can hear me? My presentation will touch briefly on four main areas outlined on the slide. Next slide. Much can be said about public-private partnerships and also the private sector response to the HIV/AIDS crisis. However, my intention in the 5 minutes I have is to just really give you some of the main highlights from the GBC's perspective, and also share a flavor of the range of ways companies are and can further respond to HIV and AIDS, and how this can be strengthened due to public-private partnerships to address the needs of women and girls, and to bring about more leadership and resources to the table that's geared towards women and girls. Next slide. Very briefly on the GBC. The GBC is a global business coalition on HIV, AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. It is an organization of over 200 companies from all over the world, and it brings business together to respond to the three diseases. It first initially was addressing HIV and AIDS, and last year added on TB and malaria. We have our headquarters in New York and regional offices in Paris, in Geneva, where we act as the focal point to the private sector delegation to the Global Fund, and currently chair the board of the Global Fund, in Beijing, Moscow, Kiev, Johannesburg, and most recently here in Nairobi, and the Nairobi office covers East, Central, and English-speaking West Africa. The mission of the GBC and why the GBC was created, really at an urging of the former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, was to harness the power of the global business community to fight the three diseases. Next slide. So before getting into how public-private partnerships are strengthening the response to HIV and AIDS, and especially the needs of women, I just wanted to quickly, you know, set the context by giving one definition of what it is when we talk about public-private partnerships. The definition on the slide is from the ILO in 2005. And basically, what it means is that a public-private partnership is an arrangement that brings together business and following partners. In 2005, this definition was looking at it between the state and the private sector. But we've seen that this has expanded to involve a lot more stakeholders, from NGOs to bilateral, multilateral, governments, community-based organization, faith-based organization. And in a public-private partnership, all the parties participate in defining the objectives, the methods, and an agreement of cooperation in order to jointly deliver a program or service. Effective public-private partnerships require high levels of confidence from every party, respect of each party's contribution, and joint decision and accountability. The rationale for why we get into partnerships It's so that we can have rapid scale-up and program strengthening. We can increase, we can have greater impact and outreach. If each of the partners come in with their strengths and with their expertise, we can multiply the number of people we're reaching. We can also increase the efficiency and coordination by each of us leaning on our expertise. And in addition to the innovation, the efficiency that partnerships bring. Okay, so next slide. One type of public-private partnership you'll hear from the private sector being talked about a lot is co-investment. In the HIV/AIDS context, co-investment is a mechanism for joint investment of public and private resources to provide access to HIV/AIDS information and services. So in other words, co-investment is a specific PPP aimed at strengthening and scaling up the AIDS responses beyond a company's premises. We've now been able to broker a lot of co-investment partnerships where companies have been able to open up their infrastructure or deploy their employees in partnership with community-based organizations. So where this is extended then to the community if it's to provide access to healthcare, as well as bring in a donor like the Global Fund or PEPFAR to help support the broader community rollout. So let me move on. I won't spend too much time on that. One question that many people ask is, what role can business play in the fight against HIV/AIDS beyond philanthropy and in a way that strengthens the response to HIV and AIDS? Often, we don't see business at the table. And the truth of the matter is, business is doing a fraction of what it can do. So one of the things that we do at GBC is mobilize and show business the range of ways that they can get involved. When you look at companies' corporate social responsibility programs and the budget, it's really a fraction. And so we have to see what are the different ways in which we can engage with business so that we can bring more resources to the table that is addressing women and girls. And the four main areas that GBC works with them is on taking business action in the workplace, extending that into the community, using core competencies, the products, the services, the expertise of business, and finally the advocacy and leadership together with the public sector. Go on. I won't spend too much time, but basically when we talk about, you know, workplace program, these are the basic elements of a global policy that we say that companies need to institute. And this is the basic framework from which the PPPs become important to scale up and increase the reach and depth of the company's efforts. So how are PPPs, next slide, so how are PPPs strengthening the workplace response to HIV and AIDS, and especially those needs that address women? So leveraging on the existing infrastructure and in-country relationships, companies in countries, and especially companies that are operating in affected regions, can provide mechanisms for service delivery and can influence in the communities where they function by providing comprehensive non-discrimination, prevention, testing, and treatment programs to not only their workers, but extend that to spouses and dependents. And it's very important for companies who have large male workforces to extend that coverage to spouses and dependents so as to get more women and children into the net. Secondly, especially in Africa, we see majority of the women are in the small and medium-sized enterprises. And so when working with large companies, we work with them to see how can the efforts that they're rolling out in their workplace be extended to the supply chain and to the small and medium enterprises so that women can also benefit from the efforts that the companies have put in place. Thirdly, through public-private partnerships, post-employment coverage for care support and treatment for workers, spouses, and dependents is possible.
Oh.
And again, please let me remind the panelists, let's try to keep it to the 5 minutes. Next we have Terry McGovern. Terry's going to share her experience on Terry's going to share her experience of effective funding strategies. What gets funded, what does not get funded, I think very essential. And how can women's groups increase their chances of getting some funding?
Good morning. Thank you. It's a huge honor for me to be at this meeting on this continent with all of you. My vision is limited not only by my height, but by my country of origin. So I've learned a lot at this meeting, and I want to thank the organizers. What is funded? As we all know, there's lots known about the epidemiology of this disease. We know how many people have it. We know where they are. We know people are positive who don't know themselves that they're positive. Someone knows. There's lots of research into science, vaccines, targeted interventions, testing, male circumcision, abstinence. There's a strange list of funded programming, often with little attention to implementation issues, rights, context, structural barriers. Lots of funding to big organizations to implement these schemes. What isn't funded? A wide range of economic empowerment strategies, employment opportunities for HIV-positive women, capacity building for small NGOs, grassroots groups, organization building, policy, technical assistance, research that is aimed at developing interventions, not just studies that attempt to prove there's no link between conflict and HIV. How about studies about how to address HIV in conflict settings? Legitimate strategies to build Southern leadership from new sources. Conflict is tremendously underfunded. I have very little time, so I want to give my perspective on what needs to happen to have meaningful participation of affected women. HIV-positive women working in collaboration with true partnership with women's rights service organizations need to figure out what the strategic access points are nationally, regionally, and globally. You can increase your funding chances by being strategic. Obviously, the Global Fund, country coordinating mechanisms, UNAIDS, PCB, other places at the country level, Global Fund, G8, UNDP, wherever it will truly make a difference, we need women to be there. We funders have a lot of women asking us for money to attend meetings, but there's not a lot of strategic thought about which meetings. Where do we need to be? Be very specific about what you want to achieve. I want to give some examples of things that I've seen in my year at Ford. Proposals on violence, women, and HIV, papers on the need to integrate HIV into SRH, papers on conflict in HIV, papers on integrating human rights into HIV work, but rarely do these proposals do more than explore the intersections. We need specifics. How do we fix these vertical systems? How do we ensure that our clinics, that there are clinics in conflict settings, A, and they know how to address HIV? What protocols need to change so that these things can be operationalized? Violence against women. What does zero tolerance for gender-based violence in the context of HIV mean if there is nothing in the national plan that ensures that there are links between HIV testing, domestic violence counseling, legal assistance, whatever it is that works? How can we say we are using a rights-based approach if nothing in the plan provides any kind of advocacy to change inheritance laws, marital rape laws, or make legal assistance available? We have to go further in our strategies. The fact that all these issues, violence, rights, poverty, racism, homophobia, stigma, intersected to create a perfect storm for this epidemic to flourish in women has been clear for a very long time. We need concrete proposals on how to fix it and how to operationalize fixing it. If the Global Fund needs to be pressured so that the country coordinating mechanisms are more accessible to small women's groups, well, then that needs to happen. If the criteria needs to be changed, then that needs to be happened. The gains that have been made in HIV around drug pricing have been targeted campaigns, litigation, social movements, people working together, positive women at the forefront in collaboration with others, parity in groups from Asia and Africa, not just groups from the global north. In closing, I just want to say something else. When you get proposals at the Ford Foundation from the Global North versus the Global South, the Global North organizations and many men's organizations are very comfortable in using language like, we have best practices, we have models to be replicated, we can design, implement, and evaluate, we have work that has global implications. You rarely see women's groups that are doing amazingly creative things use this terminology. There's this, as I heard a speaker say yesterday, an inequality of ability to claim rights that we need to be aware of, and we need to start claiming those rights. And I know it's very, very difficult, and I know that the Ford Foundation can't fund every little group that's out there, but I do think advocacy at these points could begin to get money to some new places. So thank you.
Excellent, Terry. Thank you very much. And I think a very clear message there, concrete and holistic proposals required, and women simply do not scream about the things they do, and we really, really should start talking about the things we do. Okay, next up is Bisi Adeleye-Fayemi. Bisi is going to share her experiences on the politics of funding in Africa and what challenges these present to accessing resources for HIV programs for women and what solutions are there to this.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We can't talk about money if we don't feel some passion. Now, I'm absolutely terrified of our moderator. So I am not going to talk about the politics of funding in Africa, because that's going to take me at least 30 minutes. What I am going to talk about is the politics of funding our own revolution. But just before we get there, let me locate myself for a minute. I'm with the African Women's Development Fund. We are an Africa-wide grant-making organization. We support African women's organizations with grants. Since we started awarding grants 6 years ago, we've funded over 400 women's organizations in 42 African countries, and we've given out something in the region of $5 million. And Zawadi made my day by confirming that in 2005, AWGF gave out more money in Africa than the World Bank, CEDA Sweden, and UNDP. My board member, Elizabeth, with UNDP is at the back, so I wonder what you'll have to say about that later on. Now, the question before us is, if women really matter, where is the leadership and the money? Now, this question makes certain assumptions that we think because we are women and we know that we matter, other people think that we matter. That's not the case. And it goes back to the politics of funding that Zawadi was talking about earlier on. Funding for women's rights work is political. And the reason why we don't have enough money for the work that we do is simply because we are trying to dismantle systems and processes and behaviors and attitudes that have been in place for millennia. We are trying to dismantle patriarchy. We need to be able to come to terms with the fact that that's what we are in the business of doing, however we want to define ourselves, whether we want to call ourselves gender activists, gender mainstreamers. I call myself a feminist with a capital F. The famous African American writer Audre Lorde, and this is something I say whenever I give speeches about money, so please forgive me if you've heard it before and I'm boring you. But Audre Lorde once said, the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. They will only allow you to use them to beat him at his own game temporarily. So if we want a revolution, if we want to dismantle patriarchy, we have to be able to provide those resources ourselves. Which brings me to the conveners of this meeting. the Young Women's Christian Association, the Worldwide WCA. Maybe you are not all young, but you're all women and Christian, and according to our notes, there are 25 million of you. And I've done a bit of homework. For the past 7 years or so, you've been trying to raise an endowment, and the target is $25 million, right, Musimbi? $25 million, which means each member of YWCA should be able to give at least $1 to this endowment fund. And I understand that the endowment now stands at $10 million. YWCA members, I challenge you now, over the next 2 years, why don't you raise the rest of this money from your own ranks? Minus Ford Foundation, minus the bilaterals, minus the businesses. This is something that we can do for ourselves. Moving on, I think we, in spite of the fact that we know we can't fund our own revolution, we shouldn't let people off the hook, so we need to intensify our advocacy with governments, the bilaterals, the multilaterals, the businesses, and the foundations. But for us to be effective advocates for women's rights work, we have to feel the passion. We also need to look into other constituencies which we take for granted, like our diaspora communities, however we define our diaspora. And many of us have run successful programs using resources from our diaspora. Some home truths here, because we are all part of the global women's movement, however we are located within that movement. We need to revisit the structures that we have put in place to do this work that we're doing as a global women's movement, to work on a variety of issues, whether it's HIV/AIDS, whether it's economic empowerment, whether it's political participation. Is the architecture, let's use that image now, is the architecture of this movement functioning well enough? Do we have too many mansions on the same street? Maybe too many bungalows? Maybe there are some houses where we need to change the windows? Maybe we need to fumigate? So we need to try and revisit how we are doing our work as women's rights organizations. We also need to take leadership. Again, let's not hang around waiting for when the Global Fund for Malaria and AIDS and Global Fund for HIV/AIDS and Malaria will change their criteria so that we can fit in. Let us take leadership wherever we are and say, this little bit I know I can manage, and I can mobilize resources to support women in my own community without having to, you know, go out of my boundaries. And as I close, I'm going to give an example of how my organization, the African Women's Development Fund, has done that. Since we started grant making, we've funded in 5 thematic areas, and HIV/AIDS has been tucked away in health and reproductive rights. But 2 years ago, we decided that we could do more. We want to be able to increase the resources available to African women around HIV/AIDS. And we actually got tired of listening to how much all these large donors claim to be put into HIV/AIDS in Africa. And we knew that none of that money was getting into the hands of the communities that we work with on a day-to-day basis. So what we did was we set up a dedicated HIV/AIDS fund. And we invited our dear sister, Musimbi Kanyoro, to Accra to help us launch the fund in November 2005. And when Musimbi was giving her speech, Musimbi said, let's look at the statistics we are working with here. We provided the information, but we hadn't actually internalized it. She said, for every 10 African men with HIV/AIDS, we have 13 women. There are 13.1 million African women living with HIV/AIDS, and we have approximately 13 million HIV orphans. Why don't we do something about the number 13? And so she challenged every woman and man in the audience to put $13 on the table, the equivalent of $13 in their currency, or $130 if they can afford it, to $1,300, to be part of what she called a 13 movement. And so AWGF, we've taken a cue from our dear sister Musimbi, we've launched the 13 campaign, and for those, some of you were at the event we did 2 nights ago, it's simply about African women taking their own destiny into their own hands, mobilizing resources from their own communities to support work around HIV/AIDS. So let us all fund our own revolution. We matter. We have the money, and we have the leadership. Thank you.
Thank you very much, BC. Next, I'm calling on Sono Aibe. Now, Sono is going to address the issue of funding for women's reproductive health and rights and make a link of how reproductive health affects HIV infections in women.
I want to thank the Worldwide WCA for inviting me to be part of this very distinguished panel. The conference has really been inspiring for me. I have really never been in the company of so many energetic, powerful, friendly, and engaging women leaders gathered all in one place, celebrating successes, solidarity, and sisterhood. It's truly empowering. I first wanted to share a few words with you about the topic of donor funding from the viewpoint of the Packard Foundation. The David and Lucille Packard Foundation was established in 1964 in California with the mission to improve the lives of children, enable the creative pursuit of science, stabilize world population, protect reproductive rights, and conserve and restore the Earth's natural environment. It is a family foundation built on the business philosophy and personal values of David and Lucille Packard. They were passionate about supporting people and organizations that show leadership over a long period of time and take risks to advance their work. And we are a proud supporter of the Worldwide WCA. The Packard family's beliefs have guided our longstanding commitment to expanding reproductive health options among the world's poor. For over 40 years, the foundation has been investing in pioneering organizations that give women and their families the ability to have children when they are ready and able to care for them. We make investments in reproductive health services in some of the least developed areas of the world and in the United States. We do this because families everywhere want to decide how many children to have and when to have them. And yet millions of people, especially women, don't even have access to basic health care that would enable them to do so. We strive to give them this access by supporting programs that bring services closer to them. I wanted to emphasize the important connection today between reproductive health and HIV/AIDS programs and the need for linkages between these two that are often missed, sometimes even by health professionals. As you have been hearing at this conference from experts, the overwhelming majority of HIV infections among women are sexually transmitted. HIV/AIDS is therefore very much a women's reproductive health issue. We believe that the more we can give women control over their sexual and reproductive lives by giving them access to reproductive health services, the more they can protect themselves against HIV infections. Among the most basic health care for women and girls are sexual and reproductive health services, which could include pre- and postnatal care, contraception, diagnosis and treatment of other sexually transmitted diseases, prevention of mother-to-child transmission, and combating sexual violence. It also includes medically accurate sex education, especially for young people. Investments in these areas can help protect women from AIDS, given that through these services, women will come into contact with the health system, learn about how their bodies work, and take home the knowledge of what they can do to prevent contracting HIV. As Dr. Margaret Chan said in her speech, we must all advocate together to strengthen health systems, especially for sexual and reproductive health services, and especially for preventive health care to serve the critical needs of women and girls. I'll now say just a few words about the Packard Foundation's funding strategy to respond to sexual and reproductive health needs. The foundation has made a number of grants to organizations that are advocating for and testing models of health services that link reproductive health care to HIV/AIDS programs. One example is an ongoing study that is looking at the public health benefits of including contraceptive services in voluntary testing and counseling centers in Ethiopia. A baseline survey found that few voluntary counseling and testing providers counseled clients about contraception, despite the fact that the majority of HIV-positive clients said they wanted to prevent pregnancies in the immediate term. The next step in this study is to implement an AIDS counseling and treatment program that links to other reproductive health services and to measure client satisfaction and uptake of services to identify the best model of practice. We're aware that global funding available for AIDS programs often do not take the reality of women's and girls' lives into consideration, and therefore are not effectively addressing the feminization of this epidemic. Harmful U.S. policies regarding reproductive health programs also need to be improved, and the Packard Foundation works with many partners to advocate for alternative policies that respect women's and girls' rights. While our foundation has its mandate and its limitations, we hope to move more resources in coming years to address the root causes of the disproportionate HIV infections among women and collaborate with other partners to fill the gaps. There are three things that YWCA members can continue to focus on to promote better reproductive health and to prevent HIV/AIDS. Number one, make sure government budgets include line items for women's health care services and medical supplies, and if not, advocate for those. Number two, engage men and boys as partners. Number three, actively establish referral systems that link your associations to existing reproductive health services that are being delivered by government and NGO partners. In closing, I would like to emphasize that reproductive health must be taken into account when looking at what it takes to improve the future of women. And we hope that together, we can urge more and more donors to join us with their funding to address this urgent and too often neglected issue. Thank you.
Very much. And finally, we call on Dr. Musimbi Kanyoro, and Daktari is going to tell us if women's organizations wish to be funded in ways that can guarantee change, accountability for resources and leadership of those organizations is essential. So how can women's organizations strengthen their accountability and their leadership? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Jambo. That's excellent. You're all such good Swahili speakers. Very often when women's organizations or civil society people apply for funding anywhere, the first things that donors ask is, what about their accountability? So I just want to use some of our examples of accountability and what our experience has been in also talking to our partners in the women's organizations. There are various ways in which we can show our accountability. I want to mention by name the ones that I found most important. One, the donors understanding the clarity of our purpose. Why do we exist? What exactly are we doing? And why are we doing what we are doing? That's very important. The next one that I have found very important is that they want to know what kind of governance is in place to hold the staff accountable. Because very often the staff are in the office doing the day-to-day things that need to be done, writing the projects, sending them, making them sure that they are in time, etc. But donors want to know who holds the staff accountable. In the movement, in the women's movement, we are quite good at electing boards. But we are not very good at evaluating our boards and at making sure that the boards also know that they are really held accountable by donors and other stakeholders. Very often, in many local women's movements that we've seen, the boards think that they are accountable just to see that the staff is doing their work. But no, the boards really are accountable also to donors, feeling confident that this organization is well run. The next one that I want to speak about is the human resources, the staff. The staff in women's organization is one area where we're not doing extremely well, because as we've seen, many both local, rural, and even international organizations, women, we have learned over the years to recycle every shilling, dollar, penny, etc., and to work as volunteers, which is just wonderful. This world will never do without volunteers. But one of the things that has always been done is how very understaffed the women's movement is, if staffed at all. In most women's movement, there's just very, very a skeleton of staff, such that that staff is not able to sustain both running an office, being accountable to the stakeholders, the people we care for, and at the same time being accountable to donors and even to its boards. If we have to go into the future with accountability as a big subject, we must begin to think about staffing our women's organizations. And when we staff them, we have also to think about paying them remunerations that go with justice. Because I think it's unfair for women's organizations to look for rights and justice, etc. And when we employ our own staff, we pay them right under and under and under what is allowed in the market value for the services that they provide. In this region of staff and boards, again in the women's movement, we would like, probably as YWCA, based on our experiences, to suggest that there be continued research on how we can continue to build better working relationships between boards and their staff, with no knowledge of where the boards are in terms of the responsibilities. The boards are there to ensure governance. The staff are there to ensure management. And part of our accountability is to know the limits and the extent to which these distinctions are made. And then the last one that I would like to talk about, because there are quite many, but the last one is regarding the financial management, financial responsibilities of whatever that we receive from the donors. The women's movement is strong in visioning what needs to be done, in understanding where the women's needs are, where the community needs are, where the children's needs are. This is very clearly present in the women's movement. But I think where the weaknesses are is sometimes there isn't sufficient expertise in the movement to think bigger in terms of financial management or what the funds will do. We've seen by our experience that sometimes we look with such small lenses. We're going to look at HIV and we look at one orphan or one school. We don't think sufficiently big enough to say we're going to look at the whole village. We're going to look at the whole district. We're going to look at the whole province and we're going to look at the whole country. We've been used for so long into working in small little groups, which are good, but HIV/AIDS is calling us to think bolder and know that because this pandemic is so large and so urgent, we are not going to be able to do a whole lot if we don't think about how we could manage bigger funds and scale up the reach so that more people would benefit from the kind of funding that we receive in our hands. And finally, rendering accountability by providing the impact of our work. We do, and we do, and we do very well, but we don't sufficiently evaluate our work. So that when donors ask us very often, what is the impact you are making? In our hearts we feel it. Through our knowledge we know it. But we have not always been strong at transferring what we know to the donors who may not be close to us. And so this is an area too that we in the YWCA have begun to think strongly about and ask that the whole of the women's movement, we begin to really look to say how do we communicate the impact of our work. And as I go to sit, I want to say that the World YWCA has begun to work with the standards of good management and accountability, which are there. These standards really hold us accountable to our stakeholders. And the first on the list of our stakeholders are the people whom we are working for. So if it's HIV/AIDS, it's the people who are living and who are with HIV and AIDS, or people who are affected with HIV and AIDS. And then the list goes on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. A bit easier from here. Right, there are mics on the aisles. So if you do have a question, please make your way to the aisles and we'll start taking questions right now. There's one over here. And there's a couple, I think, on that end. So please make your way to the aisle. Excellent. Go ahead, please.
Thanks. Good morning. Marilyn.
Introduce yourself.
Yeah. Marilyn Rice Boyne, Barbados. Professionally, I'm a life insurance agent, financial advisor in Barbados. A woman who is tested HIV positive, her life is extended medically. However, in the financial world, she's dead. Because she is unable to secure life insurance. The maximum she can secure in the Caribbean region is $10,000, which is not adequate, because if her life must continue, so she would want to get a mortgage, she would want to get insurance for collateral security. As we look at the women's leadership and funding and all that, we need also to put some pressure on the reinsurance companies that they review the limits. $10,000 certainly is not adequate. They need to review the limits so that a woman could still carry on her life in a financial, from a financial perspective.
Very good. Let me take that to Patricia. That's a very good question. The insurance industry as an industry has been slow to come on board to address HIV and AIDS, and this is one industry that a lot of pressure needs to be put in. We are seeing examples of now a few insurance companies coming up with products that are extending coverage, and especially to women and girls. And these are some of the products that we need to highlight in terms of the industry to take up these models of best practices. I'll refer you to Old Mutual and Metropolitan, who have recently launched products for insurance. But what we found with industries, it's very much a name and shame game, and we need to be doing that. We need to name the companies that are responding in a very innovative and responsible way, and we need to shame the companies that are lagging behind and show them what can be done. So with the insurance industry, a lot of pressure needs to be done, and we are working to bring together the insurance industry to see how coverage can be extended through risk pooling and other financing mechanisms.
Okay, we're going to take four questions now and then put them to the panel. So one on that end. Go ahead, please.
Morning. I'm Harriet Kunene from Swaziland, reaching out on women and girls and boys with HIV testing and counseling in the rural communities. My question is, this has been coming on and on, like there are small organizations, they are big organizations. My question is, what's the criteria to say this organization is small, this organization is big, and what can be done for the smaller organizations to be big organizations? As one speaker rightly said, that even the smaller organizations do need funding to become big organizations. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's take the next one, please. Go ahead.
Hi. Forgive me if I ask a slightly confrontational question, and I think it actually picks up on the point that was just made.
My name, your name, please? Yes.
My name is Susanna Freed, and I am working with the Women Won't Wait campaign, and we recently published a report called Show Us the Money is Violence Against Women on the HIV Donor Agenda. I think picking up on her question, I appreciate what everybody's saying about the ways in which we need to make our own organizations more accountable. But I still have the question, and forgive me, friends, who holds the donors accountable? It is the rare donor, and the African Women's Development Fund is one that I think really tries to fund us in the ways we need funding, rather than asking us to ask for funders in the way that donors want us to ask. And until we start to change that, and I think the folks at the table are the ones who are at the inside who can start making those kinds of changes from within, we will continue to be in this kind of bind. Thanks.
Thank you. Our next question, I think, from here, please. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Joanna Kerr. I'm from Canada. And just if any of the presenters wanted to say something about the politics of faith-based funding, particularly in the context of women and HIV/AIDS. And I know some of us have talked about PEPFAR funding, but just in terms of how you see the future trends and particularly the role of the YWCA in trying to influence faith-based funding so that, in fact, it addresses women's reproductive and sexual rights.
Thank you. And that end?
Miriam from Malawi. Food and Agriculture Organization. Mm-hmm. First of all, let me say, if you are positive, you should fear God, creative, active, and productive. Mm-hmm. And the next thing is, on your funding, may you please go right at the grassroots with somebody to be found at the CD4 count. You have to have a walk of 50 kilometers or 60 kilometers to the doctor. Who can screen your CD4 count? Somebody to take the ARV. You have to first see that is what is stands out of your CD4 count. So on the funding, please think of the woman down there in the village where the clinic is 60 kilometers, 100 kilometers, and if she's tested today for the CD4 count, the results will come after 3 months. And she's already dead. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll take one more from that end, and then we'll go to the panel. One more from there. We go.
My name is Loatile Suboni from the YWCA of Botswana. HIV/AIDS is not only a health issue, but it's a socio-economic and political challenge to women. And I would like to say to YWCA today that I think it's about time that we start thinking about empowering women economically, because it's women who are poor who are most vulnerable. What are we doing as YWCA to start thinking about investments, to start encouraging women to form groups that would look into things like investing on the stock market, so that women can get out of poverty and move away from, you know, I'm one person who's against, I don't want to offend anyone, but I'm against microfinance because I think it keeps women at that low level, and women need to move out to the next level and be able to participate in the economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we'll take those questions. Now let's start with how do you actually determine the size of an organization, small, medium? How's that done? Who's, Terry, Sono, perhaps Dr. Musimbi, who would like to address that? Perhaps Terry. the Ford Foundation. Do you have a way of identifying what's a small organization, what's a medium size? How's that done?
I mean, not. I'll tell you. Can you hear me? Not that I know of, but in, at least in New York, we're limited in the amounts of grants we can give out. Each program officer has a maximum number, so that means you can't give out. You know, the only way to get to small organizations for Ford, because of the rules that obviously the program officer didn't set, is to re-grant, is to give grants to other kind of intermediaries who can re-grant to small groups.
Okay.
It's very, very difficult at the Ford Foundation to give, you know, grants that are probably less than 50,000.
Okay. The next question, who holds donors accountable? BC, can I bring that to you? Is there somebody who's looking at what the donors are doing and monitoring them?
That's a very important question. I think the only donors who we find difficult to hold accountable are the large independent private foundations because they have their own money. The bilaterals can be held accountable. If we advocate, you know, if we know how to advocate effectively with them and name and shame, the multilaterals can. We can hold our governments accountable. We can hold businesses accountable. Because every donor gets money from somewhere else and is accountable to someone else. But if people feel that they are not accountable to, say, a market or to their voting public, then it's very difficult to hold them accountable, which is where our advocacy strategies and our collaboration and our partnerships and all the things Cindy was talking about, you know, accountability, that's where all that comes in. Having said that, I know that quite a number of donors are reflecting on this. And recently, the Council of Foundations in the U.S. and the European counterparts, the European Foundations Conference, came up with what they call principles of accountability to guide grant making for many private foundations and corporate foundations. And this can be found on their website, so you can just go to Council of Foundations or ESC. So it's something that we all have to be involved in on an ongoing basis.
Okay, good to hear that. Well, let me come to you. Oh, go ahead, please, Mara.
Thank you. Yeah, I think I also wanted to say something around the accountability of donors and the suggestion that was made earlier that we need to push for donors to have included or make it mandatory in the disbursement. That they have budget lines for women. I'm also part of the Global Coalition on Women and HIV together with Mozambique, and we've had our meeting just before we started the International Summit. One of the outcomes of this is that we have made the commitment to seek approval at the from the Global Fund to Fight HIV, Malaria and TB that in the next round of funding they do make it mandatory for governments, for applicants, to have a component on women that addresses women's issues. It's a big task, but it's something that the members have taken on as their commitment for this year. I also wanted to say that recently, the International AIDS Society has removed the two seats that they had for positive people. On their board at the highest level, they had a representative from the international community of women and a representative of the global network of positive people. This meant that there would at least be a chance to have equal representation between men and women. The fact that now they are asking for only one representation means that women will now have to struggle again to have their issues on the agenda of AIDS, the international AIDS conferences and all the sub-conferences that are linked to this one. They are meeting next week or in 2 weeks in Sydney, and it's going to be a challenge for the international community of women to get their points forward and not be removed from that board. The struggle in terms of getting the donors sensitive to women's issues is a continuous one. There isn't just one approach to it. And it's good that we are able to talk about it, but it's good to just keep in mind that there's not just one approach, and it's not going to be an answer tomorrow that will last forever. It's going to be a continuous one.
Thank you. Thank you. Dr. Tari, let me come to you with the next question. The politics of faith-based funding, and what are the future trends, and what is the role of the YWCA?
I think I understand the context from which my friend John Kay is asking this question, but first of all, I want to say that one cannot say there is a certain politics of faith-based funding as a generic term. In our experience in the YWCA, our strongest and our most long-funding people have always been donor agencies that are faith-based, such as Christian Aid, ECO, Norwegian Church Aid, Dan Church Aid, Finnish Church Aid. These agencies in Europe, who have been there for a long time, fund people across everything, across denominations, in many different countries, etc. They are quite clear on the issues of justice. But I know you are asking about certain fundamentalistic approach that certain faith-based fund or limitations come with funding, especially from some of the groups that have come from North America, much more than from Europe or even Africa. And I understand that what you're asking is when they put restrictions on women on what is possible to be funded or not, because you linked it also with the PESA fund, which does have some restrictions, not as much as sometimes we popularize, because there are certain people who believe that when money comes from USAID, you wouldn't be able to use it and talk about condoms, and that's not really true, because USAID is still the largest fund of the research on condoms. But there are certain restrictions that they have put on, like making a statement that you will not promote prostitution. They're saying promote prostitution, those kind of particular things that they put in as before they fund. I personally believe that when you have a purpose and you know for what purpose you are asking for the money, if your purpose is not fulfilled, you have a right to say no to that funding. And I think it's when we are able to say no to things that we believe we are called to do in our purpose that we really show we know where we stand. And so the people will come with conditionalities. It could be faith-based group, but it could also be other donors. It is up to the organization that is applying for the funding to know what your purpose and what you stand for, and to be willing to stay with your mission and not to be swayed away from your mission.
Thank you for that. Now, Zawadi, I will come to you. And as you respond also on that issue, grassroots was mentioned. You talked about CIA in your presentation. And we know the struggles at the grassroots level. How can we ensure more funding goes to the people at the grassroots?
Hello. Thank you. First, I just wanted to answer the question about how do we determine what a small organization is. And the criteria we used for our research was organizations that had budgets under $50,000. So that's how we did that. I also want to address the issue of donor accountability, because I think that's really important when we're looking at changing our resource mobilization strategies. It's how we engage differently with donors so that we're influencing their agendas as well. And part of the work that we're doing with AVID is doing advocacy around the issue of funding for women's rights in different spaces, including the European Foundations Council. And I just want to say at this year's conference, there was one session on bringing gender to philanthropy, and this is the first time that they organized a session specifically on that issue. And one question that came up from the audience was, well, why won't the EFC bring gender to the main plenary? It is a major global challenge in philanthropy. And a response that came from one of the donors, well, was not as many people will attend because it's not that fashionable. And that's something that we really need to think about, how we're going to change that. In terms of getting more money to the grassroots organizations, two levels. One, from the grassroots, changing our resource mobilization strategies and working together with other allies and coalitions. And then from the donor side is working together, if large organizations like the Ford Foundation can't give smaller grants, then partnering with strategic partners like Women's Funds, for example, who have access to organizations at the grassroots.
Okay, excellent. So two-pronged approach. Very important. Now, Sono, let me come to you with the next question, and about health issues. It's not just a health issue. It's also a social, a political, and an economic issue. How do we empower our women economically? Is that something that the Packard Foundation is thinking about?
Yeah. We're increasingly looking at, for example, the area of agriculture and food production and how women farmers in Africa are struggling around these issues and how we can mobilize them to really, you know, form groups and be able to work more with the global trade. And I think it's equally important to say that health services really need to be brought closer to the women at the grassroots so that they can access it. And we have been trying to support many of those activities that try to demedicalize, we say, try to bring health services down further to the villages.
Closer to the people. Okay, Mari.
1, 2, 3. I wanted also to come back to the question prior to that of bringing the money to at the grassroots level. I think it's also a responsibility for those of us who are bigger and have a diverse source of funding to also look at those of us who are smaller and simplify the work. There's a lot of admin and financial management responsibilities with money coming in. And we need to be looking into simplifying for our sisters who are working on a local scale, so that it's easy also for them to manage, but also do the reporting part.
Very good. Patricia?
Sorry about this mic. No, I just wanted to add something to the question on the economic empowerment of women. And I absolutely agree that this is critical. And one of the initiatives that GBC is working on is called Healthy Women, Healthy Economies, and really looking at the economic empowerment of women as a way to increase women's access to healthcare and healthcare services, education for girls, and also various financing mechanisms. And this is also another area where business can play a vital role. And in addition to funding programs that are looking at the economic empowerment of women, also seeing how business can bring about, can support in terms of business management and financial literacy, as well as increasing, you know, credit access and also business skills.
Okay. Before we are going to have a few announcements before we close, but just before we do that, from a media perspective, I just want to put a challenge to everybody here. We're talking a lot about funding, bilateral, multilateral institutions, but we're forgetting that we have the people on the ground. And I think somebody mentioned the idea of, you know, let's try and look to ourselves as well. From a media perspective, we cover a lot of stories in the news, and we find that people immediately call in. They want to give as much as they can, even if it's a few hundred shillings. Some people are willing to sponsor for large amounts of money when they see that a cause is worthy. And I've always wondered, how do you harness Wanjiko, or the ordinary Mwananchi, the ordinary citizen, the power of harnessing their resources, whether it's funding, whether it's support in other ways? How do you do that, and has anybody considered how to actually go out and get a message similar to what you had put together? But is that a possibility, reaching out to the ordinary Mwananchi?
If I may, the future of funding for women's rights lies with local resource mobilization. And this is something that the YWCA is best placed to do, because they have very well-organized structures and affiliates across the world. there are quite a number of donors and private foundations and institutional donors who are prepared to fund local resource mobilization strategies, capacity building, and the personnel that you need, the expertise that you need, so that further down the line, you can be at least maybe 70 to 80% independent of mainstream donor funding. It's something that my organization, AWGF, is actively involved in, working with our grantee organizations to see how they can eventually become sustainable. Maybe not 100% because sometimes it is very difficult, but at least to be able to have a considerable amount of their annual budget, at least 50% of it, come from the general public in their communities. But it requires a certain amount of skill and expertise and organization and other things Usimi was talking about around accountability and transparency.
Okay, thank you very much. Our time is up. Let's give our panelists a hand. And thank you as well all very much for joining us this morning. A few announcements now before we close.